Ladies and gentlemen, we are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution.
The truth is that mutants are very real, and they are among us. We must know who they are, and above all, what they can do.
We're not what you think, not all of us.
Who are you people?
What kind of place is this?
You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Ten, nine, eight, seven, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition. 2, 1, 0. We have a liftoff. We have a liftoff, and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It is now clear of the tower.
Hello and welcome to the White Rocket Podcast, brought to you by White Rocket Books in association with the Earth Station One Network. It's one long conversation with a variety of guests about the best of popular culture. I'm Van Allen Plexico. Today's topic is the X-Men movies from Fox, starting in 2000 with X-Men and running all the way through Days of Future Past from earlier, I believe, this year.
I'm Professor Charles Xavier.
I built this school where mutants could learn to focus their powers in a positive way. And also learn that mankind was not evil, just uninformed.
You'll be safe here from Magneto, a very powerful mutant who believes that a war is brewing between mutants and the rest of humanity.
There is a war coming. You sure you're on the right side?
I've never seen anything like this before.
We are the future, Charles, not them. They no longer matter.
Hold on to something.
And here to discuss those movies with me is Percival Constantine. How you doing? Welcome aboard the show, PC.
Thank you, Van. It's great to be here. I love listening to the show.
Oh, well, I appreciate it. Why don't you tell the listeners out there a bit about who you are, what you do, and so forth?
Sure. Well, like yourself, I'm one of the new pulp writers. I started writing professionally in about 2007, and since then I've published about seven books, I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got three series running concurrently right now. I've got the Infernum series, which is kind of like a action thriller, espionage, spy type thing.
Mm-hmm.
I've got the Mythhunter series, which is more of a globetrotting adventure series. And then just recently I had the very first installment of my Prose single shot series, Luther Cross, which is more of a supernatural horror series, was just released.
You know, we're going to have to do a show. I guess I'm going to have to get Tommy on here to talk about the Prose single shots, because my first one just came out too, Alpha Omega, which is kind of a near future space opera, you know, military science fiction series. So I think that what's so neat about that is the diversity, the variety of different kinds of stories and characters that are coming out in this whole little line of e-books from Prose. It's pretty cool, huh?
Oh, it's great. And actually, it was funny because when Tommy approached it, I was actually planning on doing something just like what he was talking about. So then he said, well, how about you do it with us? Give it a try. And I said, okay, sure, why not?
So there's like 40 different authors doing these sort of serials or one-shot stories using, you know, characters, the same characters, whatever. Yeah, it's really neat. Folks out there listening, if you haven't heard about this already, just go to Amazon and any one of the authors that you probably already know from the new pulp movement, you can search, and there's just a whole bunch of us doing these periodic. Like, for example, mine is an ongoing storyline, at least at first, then it's going to get more episodic, with the same set of characters, the same situation, almost like a TV show. What
right.
is what? How is yours kind of set up? Episodic or continued or what? Or different characters or what?
I'm doing the series option. When Tommy approached me, he said you had two options. You could either do the series option where you have the same characters over the course of the length of the project, or you can do from the pen of and then your name. And that's where you just do like short stories that aren't really related at all. The only connection is that is the writer's name.
Right.
So a few people are doing that. I know, I think Bobby Nash and Adam Garcia are both doing the From the Pen of style. But then other guys like you and me and a whole bunch of others are doing the series ones. And so I'm doing it kind of it's more episodic at first. As time goes on, maybe I'll have some more overarching story arcs. But one of the biggest influences for that was the Supernatural TV series. So
okay.
I'm actually kind of approaching it like that, where at first it was very episodic, you know, just like Monster of the Week type thing.
Yeah, mine's kind of the opposite. It's funny. I have like a big origin story kind of thing to get out, which would be like the equivalent of the 3-hour Battlestar Galactica first episode, you know, and then even the two after that, you know.
Right.
And then once that's out of the way, it can kind of settle down into further adventures now that we've established the situation. So I'm currently writing part 3 on that. So
right.
Well, that's
and,
cool.
Yeah, and you and I kind of got started in the same way because we both come from the same fanfic community.
Yeah, yeah. Going, how far back do you go there?
I came in around 2001, I think it was. And that's when I came in with Marvel 2000 when that launched.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, gosh, the fan fiction community, it was a great launching pad for a lot of writers in our community. I mean, I don't know how many. I've always tried to find this out. I'm not sure how many sort of shared continuity universes existed prior to when, a couple of other people helping me out. We created the MV1, the Marvel
right.
Volume 1 universe in 1996-97.
Right.
And that was right after the Avengers website had launched in the fall of 95. In fact, it's amazing. The Avengers website has its 20th anniversary next year. I got to start getting stuff together for that to commemorate that. But yeah, that was a great breeding ground, a great testing out system, you know, a pool for incubating new writers that had the same sort of sensibilities as each other. You know, I think that all turned out to be a very good and positive thing.
Oh, yeah, it was wonderful. I learned so much about writing and characterization from the interaction in that community and made a lot of friends that I still associate with today. I mean, I wouldn't be with Pro Se or Pulpwork Press if I hadn't met Derek Ferguson.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, let us turn our attention to our major topic today. We're going to talk about the seven. I don't know why I was breaking it apart like that. We're going to talk about the 7 X-Men related movies from Fox that are kind of in a shared continuity, more or less. There's the opening trilogy. There's a couple of Wolverine movies mixed in there. And then there's been these two more recent ones that kind of combine, almost like Star Trek. There's like the Next Generation cast and the original cast combined together, you know. But I would
right.
say much more effectively than Star Trek did it, unfortunately. So let's just kind of, I guess we'll have time to spend a few minutes on each one, and we can also kind of look at, you know, occasionally do an overview of what's going on and the characters and all that. We'll just kind of work our way through it. So
okay.
We have to go all the way back to about 2000. Marvel had licensed out the X-Men, thinking that was because, you know, in the 90s, the X-Men really were riding high. The X-Men were the ship that were pulling the entire Marvel Island of Adventure along in its wake.
Right.
And it was just a given. It was a given that there would be at least one X-Men movie. And Bryan Singer brought it to fruition, and it came out in 2000. And now I've got a couple of things to say about it in general, and I want to get your kind of overall evaluation. My observation about that first movie is, if you look at it now, a good bit of it does look rather low budget.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
But what it did that was so successful, I would argue, is it was one of the first, if not the first, well, for one thing, it was one of the first, if not the first, successful team superhero movies, and that was important. But also, it really took the subject matter seriously, and they figured out how to do the costumes in such a way that they would work in a movie. Now, we can argue maybe they went too much with just everybody in black, but the fact of the matter was, that was really the first movie where a studio figured out the formula of how to take comic book four-color superheroes and make them look cool on the screen and be more serious. Would you?
Oh, yeah. What are your thoughts? Well, you know, the movie, it doesn't really hold up as well when you watch it today, especially now that we've had so much other stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of like Superman the movie, where it was brilliant when it came out. It was so groundbreaking. But now, you know, there are aspects of it that are very dated. Mm-hmm. And it really was kind of like Superman the movie in that sense, because it kind of brought comic books back to this seriousness. I mean, you could argue that Blade did it first, but after Batman and Robin, you know, almost screwed everything all up for everybody. Mm-hmm. But Blade was more of a, you know, more of a horror thing. It wasn't so much the superhero aspect was there, but it was much more subtle. With X-Men, it was right out in front.
Right. So. Absolutely. Yeah, I always think of Blade, but then I think, well, Blade makes me think more of Marvel doing like Dracula and Wolfman and stuff like that, which is fine. But I, you know, and sometimes Marvel would be really cutesy and clever and would incorporate Dracula or something into their superhero stories. But that was very rare. And usually those kind of stayed separate. And so I kind of think of Blade as its own thing, although it was very well done and certainly was very groundbreaking. But X-Men, we got this superhero team. It took the source material pretty seriously and reverently, I think. Was there anything in the first X-Men movie that really made you, as somebody who how big of an X-Men fan would you say you are or have been?
Well, I'm a huge X-Men fan. Okay. I came in with the animated series in the early 90s, and then from that I've made the jump into the comics, and you know, I went to like the library and like through interlibrary loans and stuff, got like my hands on every single X-Men graphic novel I could find. So yeah, I've got, you know, like a complete run of the series. So I've read pretty much every X-Men comic ever. So
see, I generally ask my guests what first got you into whatever we're talking about. And I failed to ask you that. So I'm glad we covered it now. Yeah. I have always had a very mixed relationship with the X-Men, and many of my listeners and readers and all will know this, that and longtime friends, that on the one hand, I certainly appreciate and recognize the accomplishments, particularly of Claremont and Byrne and Terry Austin, that whole run. On the other hand, as an Avengers guy, first and foremost, Iron Man and the Avengers always first and foremost, I've always kind of looked at the X-Men as like the sibling that was making more money and more popular and better looking. So I've always looked at the X-Men with a kind of a combination of admiration and resentment.
I think it depends on when in your life you first connect with the X-Men, because like for me, you know, I was I was an awkward kid growing up. I didn't have a whole lot of friends and everything. And, you know, in junior high and high school, you know, the X-Men were my best friends. You know, it was it made you feel like they told you, you know, it's okay to be a freak. It's okay to be an outcast. Yeah. So for me, that was, you know, that was huge, a huge influence on me growing up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I came to the X-Men originally probably 77, 78, when they were just getting past the period where they had been like bi-monthly and doing reprints and were not that popular. And and the Avengers were big then with Jim Shooter and all that, and George Perez. And so I enjoyed the X-Men, but I got in on the ground floor pretty much. My first issue was about 109, 110, right after Thunderbird was killed, right around the time that I think my first issue actually was the carnival, the one where all the X-Men have been brainwashed into thinking they're carnival hands, and the Beast has to kind of go and rescue them. And as an Avengers guy, that's probably why I bought that issue, because it featured the Beast. And I've always thought of the Beast as an Avenger first, which just shows you how Avengers I am, right? But and so during the 80s, I appreciated, you know, what Claremont was doing and everything, obviously. But by the end of the 80s, I mean, they had really just lost me. The comics had become kind of complex, and there was so much backstory and so many new characters always coming in. What's your kind of take on before we get back in the movie, since we're talking about the origins of this of these characters? What's kind of your take on the history of the comics, very briefly, as far as how that goes?
Well, I mean, it's kind of hard to to say looking back, because you're absolutely right, it was very complex at that time. But you know, when I came into the X-Men in the early 90s in the comics, that's all I knew. That was, you know, my first exposure to them. So, and there were tons of characters in the books that, you know, that weren't in the series, that weren't in the animated series, that I had no idea who they were. Like, you had Psylocke, and you had the whole thing with her body switching and all that stuff. So I didn't know anything about this. But it kind of encouraged me to go and look up back issues. So in a way, this is just probably part of who I am, where, you know, I just wanted to know more about it. Some people might have been turned off, but for me, it encouraged me to go back and find these back issues and kind of like study the history.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, that takes us very well back into the movies now, because I wanted to get your opinion on this. One of the things, like you say, there were about as many X-Men as there are Avengers if you put the whole, you know, roster out there over the years. Right. Maybe not quite as many, but it seems like it sometimes. But when they made a movie, it's not like making Justice League it's more like Avengers, but it's not like making Justice League where you pretty much know who the first 5, 6, 7, 8 are going to be. With X-Men, you almost, I mean, maybe there's 2 or 3 that you kind of quote unquote have to have, but even then, those 2 or 3 are not necessarily all the originals like you might think. Like with the Avengers, you got to have Iron Man, Thor, Captain America. But those were the original 3, you know. With Justice League, you got to have Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern. But those were the original ones. But with the X-Men, interestingly, it's quite mixed over time. So when they sat down to do that first movie, they had to pick out a handful of characters from that quite large cast that they thought. I assume they took the ones they thought would be most popular, but also would work best in the story. So what are your thoughts as far as the choice of the characters for the movies and how they kind of jumped all over time to get them?
Well, it's funny because if you study the production history of this first movie, which goes back to like 1990 or like maybe even the late 80s, like so many different scripts had completely different casts.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah. And in this one, I think they did a pretty good job with the cast because, you know, you've got Wolverine, Storm, Cyclops and Jean are like those are a good solid 4 characters to build the franchise around, I felt.
Yeah.
And the original script even had Beast in there, too, but he was taken out in subsequent drafts. The only one that I'm a little bit iffy on is Rogue. She just felt.
Yeah.
It didn't feel like Rogue at all. Like, it felt more like a Kitty Pryde character.
Yeah, I think they needed a young character that kind of is coming into this for the first time. And they chose Rogue, but that really kind of went entirely against the existing comic book character's history.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, it just didn't feel like the right character for me. And, like, I've never really grown comfortable with Anna Paquin's depiction of her because it just – it feels very much more, like, very young, like Kitty Pryde back when she was very, very young in those very early days.
Yeah, talking about resentment, as an Avengers guy, I've always really hated and resented Rogue because, you know, the first time I bought her first appearance off the little spinner rack at a drugstore when it was Avengers Annual number 10, where she, the first time we see her, she's just basically taken away the powers and the memory from my third favorite superhero.
Right, yeah.
So I was not well disposed toward her at all. Now, I'll say this. Movie Rogue I actually like because she doesn't have that history. So in a way, while I totally agree with you as to the how she comes across on the screen, on the other hand, for me that works.
That's understandable.
Yeah.
And I've heard other similar things about some of the other characters. Like one of the things is that people always say that actually, one of the characters that I think is really underrepresented in these movies and who's the actor actually does a really good job with what he has is Cyclops.
Yes.
Especially if I'm not sure if you've ever seen the deleted scenes in this first movie.
No, I don't think so.
There are a bunch more scenes that have to do with Cyclops and how he interacts with like Jean, how he interacts with Logan, how he interacts with Professor X. And Marsden just kills it in all of them.
Well, you know, and that's unfortunate because I like Cyclops. He's sort of the Captain America of the Avengers in a way, and the straight laced I'm of the X-Men, yeah. He's exactly. He's the, there we go again. He's sort of the straight-laced guy, and he's all, very serious, and he's also the leader, the strategist, you know. So there's a there's an appeal there to me for Cyclops. But you know what? It's kind of like there's like, let's say there's 50 X-Men characters. They choose 5, 6, 7 for the movie. But even then, they feel like they've got to focus on just a couple. And so, of course, Wolverine is going to get the vast amount of attention in these movies, and he does. And that's not necessarily a bad thing to me because he deserves it. I mean, he does a great job with it, I think. But
oh yeah, Jackman, you know, Jackman kills it in these movies. You know, he may not be like the right height for Wolverine, right. But you know, aside from that, I mean, he is perfect.
Yeah.
You know, right down to the look, right down to the personality, everything. But I think the problem, the biggest weakness in this entire series of movies is that the focus is solely on Wolverine, Professor X, and Magneto at the expense of everybody else.
Everybody else, right, yeah. So let's kind of evaluate the first one. We got a bunch of others to talk about. What kind of do you think worked the best about the first one, and what were the biggest weaknesses of the first one?
Well, the biggest strength were, you know, we mentioned Wolverine, Professor X, and Magneto, and especially the dynamic between Professor X and Magneto, setting up that and setting up the world. I think they did a really great job with that.
Yeah.
The biggest weakness is, you know, Rogue is top of the list, and after that would just be like the shoving into the background of all the other characters, and the overall plot of the first movie I didn't really like too much with the whole, you know, the machine and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I agree. I thought it was the plot of the first movie was really just an excuse to have these characters running around doing stuff with each other.
Right. Yeah.
And I was also, of course, very horrified at Magneto's helmet. But enough has been said about that.
That is a good point. It was just way too small and too tight.
Yeah, it just didn't look right. It didn't look commanding and majestic like he's supposed to look.
Right.
The other thing I would say is it really does take characters that are so rich and deep and have so much interaction and history over the years, and a lot of them do come out very cardboard flat. And I guess that's for some of them that's inevitable, but they do sort of, like you say, the big three in this movie, the Professor X and Magneto and Wolverine, at least, they do get enough fleshing out that you kind of know who at least they are. And and I don't know if we could have done, I mean, because Storm is such a fascinating character.
Given the accent Halle Berry used in this movie, I think we're better off that she didn't get more of a spotlight.
Less is more, huh? All right. Well, we can revisit anything we think of, but let's roll on and now bring into the discussion X-Men 2, X-Men United. This is the one that a lot of people think is the best. What do you think about that?
Oh, I definitely agree with that. You know, hands down, it's the strongest one of the series, I'd say.
Mm. What is it? What are some things about this one that really kind of push it up to the top like that?
Well, for one, it doesn't focus solely on Magneto as the enemy, and it casts him in a new role as more of an unwilling ally or unlikely ally,
right?
We get more insight into some of the other characters. Like, we get a little bit more Storm. We get a little bit more. We get a lot more Jean, actually.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And it does a lot of stuff that, you know, it takes what the first movie did, and back at this time when it came out, it did something rare, because back then, you know, a lot of sequels, they just rehashed the plot of the first one. X2 took it and elevated the plot and took it somewhere different. And we also got some great new characters like Nightcrawler.
Yeah, that's right. It's too bad that we never got him again, but that was almost inevitable based on who they had. They kind of really I don't know the word I'm looking for, but they, by casting, what's his name?
Alan Cumming.
Yeah, Alan Cumming. You're almost guaranteeing you won't be able to get him back again for another one. So,
well, it's funny. He actually was really psyched to do the third one, Fox kept dragging their feet about it. And we can talk about that when we talk about the next one. But eventually, you know, he just got to the point where he was like, you know what, just, you know, buy out my contract. I'm done with it, because they just kept dragging their feet over and over again.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that, because I'm a big Alan Cumming fan, and I thought he did a great job as Nightcrawler. So that's unfortunate. But Well, yeah, I agree that I like that they were able to show the shades of gray more in X-Men 2. They were able to show that Magneto is not just Dr. Doom. You know, he's more subtle than that. He's more nuanced than that. And I really like that about it. And I like this sort of relationship where, again, in the movie universe of the X-Men, you have to kind of dumb things down and whittle things down to a few primary colors. And they did that with Magneto and Mystique. They just sort of say Mystique is Magneto's right-hand woman, basically. And that was an interesting thing. I mean, I don't think we'd ever seen that in the comics, right?
No, because they were completely separate.
Yeah. So that was kind of a neat touch. So, and we got to see a few more. Who else did we get to see in this movie that we hadn't seen before besides Nightcrawler?
Well, we got more Iceman and more Pyro. Like, they had cameos in the first movie.
That's right, yeah.
This is the first time we saw Colossus.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
That's another character I think should have, they could have done more with. I was really surprised that they didn't run with him as a major character in the whole series.
I think it shows in the third movie, because every time they use him in the third movie, like, he only transforms for like maybe a second, then he changes back. So I think it was an effects issue.
Yeah. And see, now it probably wouldn't be a big deal at all, but I guess back then it was really expensive to do stuff like that. And so they used characters they could just put on a wire or do some quick, you know, visual effects that wouldn't require perpetual as they move around and everything. So
yeah, we also got William Stryker reimagined here as a military commander, as opposed to the comics where he's a insane reverend.
Yeah. And Brian Cox. I just love Brian Cox.
Oh, he was great.
He's such a great villain. He's always so good in everything. I love him in the Sharp movies with Sean Bean. I love him
He was the first Hannibal Lecter too.
Oh really? I didn't realize.
Yeah, he was in Manhunter.
Yeah, and he was also Agamemnon in Troy, which I liked. So we get more villains, we get more heroes, we just get a little bit more of everything, a little better effects, a little more money. It seemed like.
Yeah, and this one it ended on a total cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Because Jean sacrifices herself at the end, and then right as the camera's panning over the ocean, you start to very subtly see the outline of the Phoenix bird.
Yeah.
And then boom, just credits. And that was, I remember seeing this movie in the theater, and that was just like a total lose your shit moment.
Well, I think that the average theater goer just figured, okay, she died and that's that.
Right.
But those of us more in the know were like, oh, we saw something.
Exactly. Yeah. It was the equivalent for you as an Avengers fan hearing Nick Fury at the end of Iron Man saying, I'm here to talk to you about the Avengers initiative.
Right. Yeah, and you know what's funny is that I've read since then that they only put that in almost as a throwaway thing.
It was, yeah.
And it's so funny because if it had been, I think Marvel would have gotten overrun with angry fanboys and girls going crazy, because we all took that to be gospel.
Oh,
Here it comes. Get ready, you know.
They had to – that's why they added that – the scene with Robert Downey Jr. in Incredible Hulk was filmed long after the – was it filmed like at the last minute?
Yeah.
Because they're like, oh, we should throw something in here.
Yeah, it's hilarious. Amazing how it came together. So, all right. So X-Men 2, you get Stryker, you get Magneto, you get just get more of everything, but it's more that's well done. So it has everything that basically worked about the first one, but done even better.
And we also get a little bit more hints of Wolverine's history with the Weapon X project here.
That's right. Because, again, Wolverine is going to be the thing that makes it float or sink. And they're really going to ride his whole story. If there's one story they're going to flesh out, it's going to be his. And that's what they do. So, all right. Again, we can keep these two topics open. Let's roll X-3, The Last Stand in. Now.
Oh, yeah.
Here's the funny thing about it. I, of course, had read all those, you know, Dark Phoenix issues and everything. Oh, I can tell you really quickly my little Dark Phoenix story. This won't take but a second. I had a subscription through the mail to a lot of Marvel comics back in the late 70s, early 80s, because I would miss out on things if I'd buy them in the drugstore or whatever, the grocery store. That's how I would get them. And so I just had to subscribe to everything. And I subscribe to Iron Man, Avengers, and Captain America, and maybe I think I actually subscribed to Ghost Rider for a while and a couple of others. So I was missing out on issues here and there if I didn't subscribe to it. And I hadn't subscribed to X-Men because I was reading X-Men just sort of issue by issue rather than really being into it. Well, right. I go through the Dark Phoenix saga, and I think it was 136 was the next to last issue of that. I think that's right. And that's the one where it hits the fan at the end and, you know, it's on. Mm-hmm. And then I guess they get teleported away or something.
That when the Shi'ar abduct them.
Yeah. And then 137 was the big finish.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't have a subscription to X-Men, and so I kept going to the grocery store, going to the drugstore, looking for that issue, and I never got it. And so I read every issue of the Phoenix Saga except the last one in like 1980, 81, you know, whenever that was coming out.
Mm-hmm.
And I read the last issue sometime about 6-7 years ago.
Oh, wow. What a cliffhanger.
Yeah. So I couldn't even remember what was going on hardly at that point. So because we just didn't have any comic shops or anything where I lived in Alabama. So my point kind of is I did not have nearly as much of an emotional investment in that story as most people I knew. So when X3 came out, I thought it was fine. I liked it. Okay. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a problem with it. Everybody else was like, oh, no. You know, the sky's falling. And I'm like, I thought it was all right. So first, let's kind of talk about what's in that movie and what's not in that movie. And then maybe what's wrong. Why did the X-Men fans react the way they did? So,
well, I think you kind of summed it up because those three questions are all kind of the same question.
Okay.
The same answer for all three of them.
Run with it.
Well, first off, the problem is that there was nothing they left out. You know, they threw all this stuff in here, and it had I think it had a smaller budget than X2.
Yeah.
And it had like three different stories it was trying to tell at once.
Yeah.
While it was trying to keep it at a shorter runtime than X2. And then you had a director who's not really who's nowhere near as competent as Bryan Singer, who got brought in at the very last minute to direct it. The whole thing was Brett Ratner.
Brett Ratner.
And the whole thing was basically just Fox giving Bryan Singer the big middle finger.
Mm.
Because, you know, Singer had this really good plan for X3 where he wanted it to be a three-way battle between the X-Men, the Brotherhood, and the Hellfire Club over the Phoenix. And that was going to be it. That was going to be the whole centerpiece was that story.
Okay.
And he had, but then Fox kept saying, oh, we don't know if we're going to make a third one. We don't know when. If we do make it, we're not sure when we're going to start on it. So, you know, they kept dragging their feet. And finally, and around this same time, Warner Brothers came to Singer and they said, do you want to do a Superman reboot? And Superman the movie was like his favorite film. And that was a big influence on his X-Men movies. So he said yes. And once Fox heard about it, they're like, no, you have to do X-Men 3. And Singer said, well, I've already signed on to do Superman Returns. You guys said you wanted to wait to do X-Men 3. Let me do Superman, then I'll do X-Men 3. And they said, no, we're doing X-Men 3, releasing at the same time. And they're like, but you've only got like about a year now and you haven't done anything on the movie at all. So they like fast-tracked the whole thing, just rushed into it. All is basically a way of saying fuck you to Bryan Singer.
You know, and I thought because they did come out about the same time.
Yeah, actually, Last Stand came out before Superman Returns.
Man, yeah, because I remember people saying, I remember somebody on a podcast saying, if X-Men 3 makes more money than Superman Returns, there's just no justice in the world. Well, it did.
It did, yeah.
It made more money because I think that was more a statement that people didn't like Superman Returns than that they loved X-Men 3.
I think so, too, yeah. And Fox even tried to pull some shady stuff with the actors, too. Like, they told, like, Famke Janssen and Sean Ashmore were both supposed to be in Superman Returns. But Fox made them choose.
Mm.
You can either be in X-Men 3 or you can be in Superman Returns. And James Marsden said, well, you know what? Brian's done a whole lot more for me. You guys forced him to cut my scenes in the last two X-Men movies, so I'm going to be in Superman Returns. And that's why they killed off Cyclops in X-Men 3.
Uh-huh. Wow. Man. Okay. So, I thought that they still got the gist of the Dark mm-hmm. Phoenix story across in X-Men 3, even if it was a little heavy-handed. Where do you see maybe execution mistakes and false steps with Ratner and so forth in that movie?
Well, first off, the good thing about it was Kelsey Grammer's Beast. I thought he mm-hmm. was a great addition to the cast.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the negative goes, you know, they had this – it's basically like they had two movies they wanted to do, and they wanted to shove them into one. So you had the Dark Phoenix on one side, and then you had the whole Cure storyline on the other side.
Yeah.
And just, like, trying to jam them both together, and then you have Magneto's giant mutant army with a whole bunch of characters. This is when the – when Fox really starts getting out of control with the cameos.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
And so you have characters who come in for, like, a scene and then disappear. Like, Archangel was billed as this big character who's going to have a big impact on the movie because his father's involved in the Cure. And then he has... the only thing he does in the movie is... he's supposed to be the first person to get the Cure, and then he flies away, and then he saves his father from dying at the end, and that's it.
Yeah.
And he has no other purpose in the movie.
Yeah, it was sort of almost like paint by numbers. Like they were just plugging things in here and there fill a plot point rather than to actually flesh it out in some ways. Yeah, what did you think about how this movie handles their version of the Phoenix story, the Dark Phoenix story, in terms of Jean and Cyclops and Professor X and all that?
You know, it starts off really good because, you know, they find Jean and... you know, and they found a really good explanation for it because, you know, in the comics, the Phoenix is a cosmic entity. So mm-hmm. here they rooted it with her mutant powers,
mm-hmm.
which and they said that, you know, Xavier planted blocks on her to prevent her from accessing those powers. And the first part of the movie is really good. It's really strong when they're dealing with that. And like especially the scene with her and Logan when she wakes up and she starts to go crazy. That was just, like, all of that was great. But they kill off Cyclops for no reason. They kill off Professor X for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just feel like... and then after that, it's like they completely forget about the Phoenix part. And every time she's seen after that, she's almost, like, just standing in the background the whole time until the very end.
You know, I do get the sense all the way... from what you're saying, all the way through the third movie, at least, and as we continue on, we'll see... but I get the sense that Fox never fully appreciated what they had with this property because, I mean, this is very, very much like the Star Trek franchise. You know, in both mm-hmm. cases, you have a small core cast and then you have a peripheral cast and they are doing science fiction-y things on Earth and wherever, right? I mean, mm-hmm. there's a lot of similarities there and they have special powers. Like in the Star Trek case, they have a Vulcan, they have phasers, they can teleport onto their ship. So I've always said that Star Trek is a lot like superhero stuff in that way. And so I get this, but Paramount never would have just killed off random character without a plan.
Right.
They understood that they had a long running property that they were nurturing.
I think that's the thing. I think Fox wasn't expecting it to go on after this movie.
Yeah, I don't think they ever understood this was a franchise that could keep going.
Right.
It just doesn't seem like it anyway.
Especially
when you say they weren't even sure when they were going to do a third one. I mean, my gosh, you didn't see, you know, Paramount going, should we do Search for Spock? You know, I don't know. What do you think?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, all right. So again, we'll leave that open and we can revisit. They decided to make you probably know more about this than me. My understanding was at this point they decided to do several X-Men Origins movies, and there was talk of an X-Men Origins Magneto and an X-Men Origins Wolverine, among others. And the only one we end up getting, sort of, and I know there's a twist here, but the only one we actually officially with that name end up getting is X-Men Origins Wolverine. So what was the deal with that?
Well, this was kind of their attempt to kind of tie into the X-Men franchise because this was, you know, around this time, you know, Marvel Studios hit it big with Iron Man. You know, Warner Brothers hit it big with Batman Begins. So now they're like, oh, maybe we should not abandon the superhero thing. So they decided to do, X-Men Origins Wolverine. And they're also planning on doing, like you said, X-Men Origins Magneto. And there are a few other ones they were talking about. I think they may have been talking about a Storm one or maybe a Cyclops one. Or there's also talk about doing like other tie-ins with like other younger characters who hadn't been seen in the movies, like a New Mutants thing or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And Deadpool was, you know, in pretty much Fox has been teasing that. Fox had cast Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool after the first X-Men movie came out in theaters.
Wow.
So they've still been dragged. And now, you know, 16 years later, they're finally going to release it.
That's amazing.
But yeah, and that was part of the reason why they had Ryan Reynolds in this, because they're planning to spin it off. And it was a total mess. It was that's basically the I go back and forth over which one I like less, X-Men Origins or The Last Stand. And at the moment, I think it might be X-Men Origins I like less.
Well, I got to tell you, it's full disclosure to the audience,
mm-hmm.
I think I've seen all of X-Men Origins Wolverine, but I can't be sure. I just remember, I know I've seen at least part of it. I've seen all the others, of course, but I think I've maybe only seen most of it. And I remember just shaking my head at it and going, no, 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 no. So what's so wrong about this movie? Tell the folks out there that maybe haven't seen it or been a while. What is just wrong with this movie?
Well, like with X3, you know, it starts off really good. You know, you get the opening with Wolverine and Sabretooth going through all these different wars. Then they get recruited by Stryker into – it's never called Team X, but that's basically what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then he leaves them and he meets Silver Fox and all that stuff is, and then Sabretooth kills her. All that stuff is good. And, you know, he agrees to join the Weapon X project. But then at the end of the, like, right when he breaks out of the Weapon X project, you know, Stryker says wipe his memory, but they never do. So he breaks out of the Weapon X project and he goes on this rampage and he finds out. And from then on, they tried to make it into a regular X-Men movie. So you find out that Stryker is taking all these different mutants and combining them together into, you know, a Frankenstein-like monster. And then you had all this other weird stuff because they had, you know, they had teenage Cyclops being kidnapped. They had Gambit in there. They had they just kept throwing in all these cameos.
Mm-hmm.
They had Emma Frost as Silver Fox's sister and this completely nonsensical plot twist where Silver Fox was being forced to work for Stryker because he had kidnapped her sister, even though she has the power to control people's thoughts by touching them. And she's always in close proximity to him. So it just made no sense why she would go along with it.
This was the one where we saw Deadpool, right?
Yeah. And we get him in the beginning during the Team X days, before he was scarred, and Ryan Reynolds plays him and does a great job.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's got the humor, he's got the wit, he's perfect. But then we find out at the end that Weapon 11, the Frankenstein-like monster that Stryker is trying to create, is they implant all these powers into Deadpool. And then what they do is they seal his mouth shut, which... You know, he's the Merc with a mouth, and they decide to seal his mouth shut. You know, it's like doing a Superman movie where Superman's not allowed to fly.
Yeah, that's what... All right, so what's the situation with Wolverine coming out of that movie? I mean, where does he stand? Is he, at the end of that movie, is he on his way to meet Professor X at the beginning of X-Men or whatever? Or what's... Remind us all.
Kind of. Professor X appears at the end, actually. Okay. And this is one of the continuity problems that's been caused by Fox, so they don't really watch their own movies.
Right.
Because Patrick Stewart has a cameo of Professor X rescuing Cyclops and a bunch of the other mutants from the Weapon X facility. And he's walking.
Oh.
Just like he was walking at the beginning of The Last Stand.
Right. Right, right.
And, you know, and this is in the 80s is when it's set, I believe.
But then we find out he lost his...
Crippled in the 60s. Right, yes,
so.
Yeah.
Oh,
so,
boy.
Wolverine loses his memory because Stryker shoots him in the head with an adamantium bullet.
That's the part I saw, and I just went,
yeah.
Oh, no.
It's like what they did was they went through the entire movie, and then at the end they realized, oh, shit, he's supposed to lose his memory.
So we got to come up with something that sounds vaguely almost plausible.
Right.
But of course, shooting an adamantium skull with an adamantium bullet would result in an adamantium ricochet.
That's exactly what it's going to be.
It's not magic. It's just really indestructible metal. So
right. I mean, adamantium can't break adamantium. It's still indestructible.
Just think, in Avengers 2, we know how to stop Ultron now.
Yeah.
Just pull out. Stryker can gun him down in the streets.
I mean, there were some good things about this movie. You know, Jackman, you know, he brings his A game as always. Liev Schreiber was Sabretooth in this, and he's not as physically imposing as Tyler Mane was in the first X-Men movie, but he does such a better job with the material. He's so dead on. He's so much creepier. And, you know, I mentioned Ryan Reynolds as Deadpool. You know, he's born to play that character. So that was, I love that. Seeing him there in the beginning there.
So it had its moments, but ultimately not the best thing. And so the first four movies are really sort of uneven. They're up and down.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I got to say, then we get to the three home runs. Now, you may not agree, but I feel like each of the last three, for all things considered and relatively speaking, okay, have absolutely knocked it out of the park. And there's a different thing I like about each one that makes it work that way. Now, I have to say, each of them, to a varying degree, emphasizes Wolverine, which is not a bad idea. He really is the face of the whole franchise. But with X-Men First Class, which I guess this maybe this would have been X-Men Origins Magneto, sort of.
Yeah, they took elements from the X-Men Origins Magneto script and incorporated into First Class. So all that stuff where he's going around hunting Nazis, that was stuff that was originally going to be in the Magneto script.
And it's awesome, too.
Oh, yeah, that's that right there, that's the best part of the movie.
I love it.
When he's Nazi hunter like that.
I just love that this is X-Men Mad Men. You know, it's the 60s. Uh-huh. It's the Cuban Missile Crisis. As a history guy, I just love all that stuff. The way they weave it into actual history. Speaking of Mad Men, though, one of the weak spots of this movie was having Don Draper's wife, January Jones, as on Mad Men, January Jones can be utterly lifeless and a dead fish, and it works for the character.
Right. But it doesn't work for Emma Frost.
Doesn't work at all here. No. So Emma Frost is supposed to be evil and sneaky and lively and conniving and everything, not just coolly detached, you know?
Right.
But everything else about this movie, I love James McAvoy from the first time I probably saw him in Children of Dune. And then I guess in, was it Wanted?
Yeah, he was in Wanted. He was great in Wanted.
He's the best actor in the Dune 2 miniseries by far, by the way. He plays Leto II, the God Emperor, when he's younger. I thought that the stuff with set back in the old days. I mean, as much as I like Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen, and I really do, McAvoy and what's his name as Magneto,
Michael Fassbender.
Oh, Fassbender! Those two guys, such great actors, just A-list talent that they brought into this thing, and I really like that movie.
I've got mixed opinions on this movie. There's definitely stuff about it I really like. I love the first half of it. But McAvoy, he's good. The problem is I think the script is not getting Professor X right. Even as a young guy, it just feels like it's very un-Charles Xavier. Like when he's telling Mystique, you know, you should hide who you really are. And he's like almost offended by whenever she shows up in her real form. That to me is very un-Professor X-like. I can't imagine that being the same guy who goes to Nightcrawler in Germany.
Hold on. That's a great point. I took from that they were saying he had learned lessons and changed after this.
I could see that, but we don't really see that growth happening in the movie. And in Days of Future Past, I just watched the deleted scenes, and there's a deleted scene where it shows that he still isn't comfortable with Mystique in her true form. So I don't really think he's really learned anything. And so that's the big feeling for that. I mean, I understand if he's learned something, but I don't really see that happening. The other thing was I think they were trying to be a bit too cutesy with the time period, because they're like, oh, the X-Men comics started in the 60s, so we're going to set it in the 60s. And they didn't really think about it much more beyond that, because they didn't think about the continuity of the previous films. So now you've got Beast as an adult scientist in the 60s.
Right.
So now in the X-Men 3, which is, you know, it says in the beginning, it's set in the not too distant future.
Yeah.
You know, he's still like a young guy and everything.
Yeah.
Relatively young.
Anyway. 40 years later.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a.
And then you've got Cyclops' younger brother as an adult in this movie.
There are issues, certainly, with the characters. But that runs through all the movies. They all they play very fast and loose.
Right.
With characters.
Like, I don't care too much about the comics history as much, but it just felt like Fox didn't care enough about the history of their own movies.
Yeah.
Because Moira's a CIA agent here, but in X-Men 3, she's, you know, an American CIA agent. And then in the not too distant future, she's pretty much the same age, and she's a Scottish, you know, geneticist.
I mean, it's like a different person makes each one of these movies and does what they want and says the heck with how what's been done in the past. Yes.
Also, I had some issues with I didn't really like Kevin Bacon as Sebastian Shaw. I didn't really like their take on Shaw at all. He felt too proto-Magneto.
Yeah, I agree with that.
If they had made his character Apocalypse, it would have been perfect.
I don't know enough about Apocalypse to be able to comment.
Well, because Apocalypse is very, he's very about Darwinism and survival of the fittest.
Right.
So if they had spun it that way with him, you know, trying to, you know, set off this nuclear war in order to see who would survive, I could have bought the plot of this completely. But as it stands, like, the plot doesn't really make much sense, because it's like mutants are immune to radiation, so we're going to bomb everything because everyone knows that only humans are vulnerable to nuclear radiation. Everything else is going to be just fine.
You know, that's another point that it kind of occurs to me. It seems like these movies were written by screenwriters who didn't so much care about the comics and the stories and the characters.
Yeah, yeah.
They look for a hook. They look for a clever hook. I mean, going all the way back to the first one with the idea of the machine that turns everybody into mutants. Again, that's not a story that would have ever been done in the comics, because it's kind of dumb. But it totally just looks like a hook that some writer could say, oh, I'll use that, and that'll make everything make sense. And that kind of happens over and over through these movies where it seems like the screenwriter just digs around in the idea of mutants, you know, and mutation, and goes, oh, here's an idea for what's going on in this movie.
Right.
It's weird.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, they had such a good chance with Shaw because he's such a unique villain, in that he doesn't give a shit about, you know, mutants versus humans. He's a straight up opportunist. I mean, his company builds the Sentinels, for crying out loud.
Right.
So I think to strip the character of all that and just turn him into a proto Magneto was a big mistake.
I guess I totally see what you're saying. I appreciated it in terms of that I thought Kevin Bacon was effectively sinister enough.
Oh, he was. Like, he did a great job with the material that he had.
Yeah.
It's just, and it's the same thing with McAvoy. He did a great job with the material he had, but those just weren't Sebastian Shaw and Magneto in my mind.
Yeah. Well, I know. I agree. I mean, they do seem like completely different characters. And even in Days of Future Past, which we're going to get to in just a second. So let's bring in the Wolverine now.
We have to mention the cameo in First Class.
Which was, remind me?
The Wolverine cameo.
Oh, yeah. Well, you had
that was aside from the stuff with Magneto at the beginning, that was probably my favorite moment in the movie. And I had heard about it before that this cameo was going to happen, and I'm just like, oh, that sounds so stupid. But, you know, it worked out great.
Well, run us through that, because it all kind of blurs together for me. What did he do?
Okay, well, Professor X and Magneto, they're tracking down all these different mutants. And you know, this is just a case where Fox just like, let's just pick random mutants out of a hat. So they had, you know, you had like Darwin, and you had the Angel from the Grant Morrison run as the first X-Men. And so then one of the characters they go up to is they go into a bar and they see and Logan's in there smoking a cigar.
Right.
And they say, I'm Charles Xavier. I'm Eric Lenscher. And he just, and without even missing a beat, Hugh Jackman just goes, go fuck yourself.
That's right. Well, I had forgotten that Wolverine was so little in First Class. It may be one of the reasons that I like that one so much is it's the first X-Men movie we got that was not Wolverine heavy.
It was the first one without Wolverine at all, basically.
Yeah.
Like, that one scene, yeah.
So it kind of relied on other characters for once, and I consider that a pretty good thing. I mean,
I do like that they were taking a chance with that. I did think that was a good idea. It's just some of the characters they chose felt kind of like...
Yeah.
Because Fox didn't... I mean, Fox was too enamored with the time period, the QT time period thing, and I felt like they didn't know if this was going to be a reboot or a prequel. And, like, the producers had conflicting statements when the movie was first released about whether it was a reboot or the prequel, so I don't even think they really knew. But I think this movie would have been much better if they did Professor X and Magneto, and the First Class was Mystique, Beast, Scott, Jean, and Storm.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that, and if they had done it like set in the 80s or the early 90s or something like that, would have worked a lot better, I think.
Yeah, but again, like I said, they found their hook, and that's what they were going with. Continuity, exactly. The heck with it. So
exactly.
Well, they didn't have much Wolverine, if almost none, in that one, but they sure tried to fix that, quote-unquote, with the next one by giving us all Wolverine. And
yep.
I have to say, was that 2012, I believe, that came
2013.
Out? Wolverine, okay. 20. Yeah, okay, that's right. 2013, yeah, that's right, because 2012 was a great movie year, in my opinion.
Right, that was Avengers and Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, and I believe maybe even Prometheus, which again, I...
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That go back to episode one of this show, and you'll see what Mark Buskett and I had to say about that movie, which was it's makes no sense at all, but you still kind of like it.
I do kind of enjoy it. I like Prometheus.
So, Brain Dead, you kind of enjoy it.
So
2012 was a really... and John Carter. So 2012 was a really good movie year. 2013...
Skyfall, too. Wasn't that out in 2012?
That was sort of the downside of 2012, but
that's right. Yeah, I forgot you didn't really.
I'm the one that doesn't like Skyfall. I'm the one, but 2013 though, you had not that many really good movies, and so
no.
Ended up, I believe, Thor 2 ended up being my favorite movie of the year, and even it was nowhere near a perfect movie. And I believe The Wolverine ended up being my second favorite movie of this entire year, not just because I enjoyed it that much, but because compared to everything else that came out that year, it was pretty darn good.
Right.
What were your preliminary thoughts about The Wolverine?
Well, you know, it's kind of funny because that summer there were three big comic book movies. There was The Wolverine, there was Iron Man 3, and there was Man of Steel.
Now, Into Star Trek Into Darkness, too. Oh, Lord, right. Last year was the Armageddon of movies I should have liked, and so it kind of defaulted its way up there.
And it was funny because my expectation going into the summer was Iron Man 3 was going to be the best,
mm-hmm.
Man of Steel was going to be a close second, mm-hmm. and Wolverine was going to be a distant third.
Yeah.
And it was like a complete opposite of that.
Yes, yeah. Yeah,
I go back and forth on which I hated more, Iron Man 3 or Man of Steel now, but the Wolverine, I really love that. I mean, for one, I live in Japan, so
mm-hmm.
being able to see, you know, a superhero movie set in Japan was a really cool thing for me.
Yeah. How did it go over there, by the way? Did people seem to like it?
People loved it. Yeah, I went to see it in the theater here, and people, you know, people really got into it. Overall, it's a really good movie. It, you know, it pretty much ignores everything from X-Men Origins, which is good. It picks up from the end of The Last Stand in a way that really works out, and they're able to make that ending work for them. And the biggest fault with this movie is that I think Fox got a little bit afraid that they weren't making it superhero-y enough, so that's why they threw in things like Viper and the Silver Samurai as giant, you know, cyber armor type thing.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff was a little bit unnecessary, I thought.
No, I agree. No, I thought what worked about this movie was that they made it kind of it was like a period piece to a certain degree, at least part of it, and then and then came forward with it and focused. Yeah. They focused so tightly on Wolverine. You finally didn't get bogged down in a bunch of other characters that, on the one hand, needed more time to be worth having. But on the other hand, if you spend more time, you water down the main thing. This movie was very focused. It was very tight. It had a very interesting story to tell, and I thought it did it very effectively, and it didn't get distracted by other things like the other movies.
And we get and contrary to X-Men Origins, in this one, they give Wolverine a love interest who's actually an interesting character.
Yeah.
I mean, what was that? Tao Okamoto, her portrayal of Mariko was, spot on perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she had that whole kind of delicate thing that Mariko had in the beginning of the comics, but she also had that kind of like warrior woman thing that Claremont introduced later on, and they seamlessly melded those two things together.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, I always suspected that what happened with Claremont was that he saw Shogun.
Probably.
And immediately had to put Mariko, the Japanese princess love interest, into his story. That was, and so Wolverine became John Blackthorne, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, I love this movie. There are some things that, I mentioned Viper and the Silver Samurai armor. That was not necessary at all. And making Yukio a mutant didn't really serve the plot at all, because the only thing she serves to do is basically to be wrong with her predictions of the future.
Okay.
And, but yeah, like, other than that, like, the cast was great. And Rila Fukushima, she's going to be in Arrow now. She's going to be playing Katana.
Yeah.
I wish we could have gotten more of William Lee's, because his character was supposed to be the Silver Samurai in the comic books.
Mm-hmm.
So I wish we could have gotten more of that. But other than that, I thought it was a decent enough adaptation of the Claremont Miller Wolverine miniseries.
Right. Yeah. So they had done two that I really like now. Mm-hmm. And then comes the one from, I guess, earlier this summer, right?
Yep.
Now, this was interesting. Days of Future Past is one of the better Claremont X-Men stories ever. It's hard to imagine now, in this day and age, that it was two issues and then done.
Yeah, I know. It's so surprising when you go back and look at it.
It was just like they were doing other stuff, and then here came these two issues back-to-back where this story happens. It happens, it's done, it's gone, it's forgotten about, it's moved on. But, in this day, today, nowadays, it would be a 12-issue thing with tie-ins and everything else.
Exactly, yeah.
But it was a very concise story. I think that helped because they were able to flesh it out more in the movie. Mm-hmm. And I actually felt like all the stuff that they added to the movie worked. And A, it made it a bigger, better story for a movie. And B, it tied it very well into First Class, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So let's now we've gotten to the last one. What are your overall impressions of? Well, and let me say this: before it came out, the fan community seemed to be very divided. There were people that said, "Oh, this is going to be great," and there were people like, "Oh, they're going to screw up this great story." Mm-hmm. When it came out, some of those people may have switched sides. There may have been some musical chairs, but you still had some people that said it was great and some people said, oh, it mm-hmm. screwed up a great story. So where do you fall on that?
You know what? I was optimistic going into it because, Singer coming back to the X-Men.
Yeah.
And so I was really looking forward to it. When I saw it, at first I really liked it. Since I've seen it again, I bought it on iTunes when it came out last week.
Mm-hmm.
I've kind of cooled. I don't hate it, but I've kind of cooled on it a little bit.
So what changed?
I think it was just like the excitement was the big thing that really influenced me when I first saw it in the theater. I think what it is we've been spoiled by the Marvel movies because, I saw this before I saw Guardians of the Galaxy. And,
right.
Going to see Guardians of the Galaxy when I was back in the States last month and then coming home and then watching Days of Future Past again, I'm just kind of like, eh. If this movie had come out 5 years ago, I would have loved the hell out of it. But right. I think we've just got spoiled with how well Marvel's been making their movies now that a lot of the stuff that Fox is doing with the X-Men, it kind of feels like, this is stuff they should have been doing 10 years ago.
Hmm. Yeah. Like they haven't kept up with the progress of the
right, exactly.
of the genre, maybe.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, I thought that what they that I mean, I like the idea of the original story where it's not Wolverine that travels in time. It's some character that I didn't even know who she was.
Yeah,
Kitty Rachel Pryde. I thought it was Rachel or something.
Oh. No. Rachel sends Kitty's consciousness back into time.
Oh, okay.
And then Rachel traveled back in time a few years after that and became stuck in the past.
Okay. Yeah, there's a lot of time travel going on in Claremont stuff, and it gives me a headache.
Yeah.
So, like, an older Kitty Pryde comes back and gets the X-Men to rally to go and prevent.
And this is the first introduction of Mystique, I believe.
Maybe so. That's interesting.
I think it was her first. It was her first introduction. It was her first introduction because I think the Ms. Marvel stuff came after this.
The first time I saw Mystique and the new Brotherhood of Evil Mutants is when they were assassinating Senator Kelly.
That was Days of Future Past.
And that's Days of Future Past. Okay.
Yeah.
I remember the future stuff from Days of Future Past, but I'd forgotten kind of what was going on in the present day. It was where the X-Men – because that was weird. They used Senator Kelly in the first X-Men movie, and mm-hmm. So he wasn't available for this one, which was
right. Kind
of odd. I mean, but they turned him into Hydro Man, and we never saw him again.
So instead they used Bolivar Trask. And so instead of Mystique killing Senator Kelly and that setting off the future, it's she kills Bolivar Trask instead. Which, ironically enough, in the comics at this point, Trask had been dead for years.
So what works best in Days of Future Past, in your opinion?
I think what works best, you know, it's great seeing Stewart and McKellen on screen again as Xavier and Magneto, and I wish we had gotten more of them together. I loved the stuff in the future. I thought they did really good with that, and I wanted to see more of it, especially with Blink. I thought they did a great job with Blink.
Yeah.
I would have liked to see a little bit more stuff in the future. The stuff in the past, I like McAvoy's Professor X a whole lot more than I did in First Class. Mm-hmm. And I also liked Jennifer Lawrence's Mystique a lot more than I liked in First Class. Nicholas Holt is Beast. He is not Beast to me. He just doesn't feel like that character. He feels too much of a milquetoast. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he doesn't seem like Hank McCoy, I guess.
Exactly, yeah.
No. But, I mean, he's engaging. I mean, I like him okay as an actor and a character, but I agree he doesn't seem like that particular one. But that being said, I do think he brings something to those two movies, mm-hmm. very effectively. What's the worst probably transgression that Days of Future Past makes then?
I think it would be spending way too much time in the past at the expense of stuff in the future.
Okay.
And also, there's kind of a disconnect between the. There's still kind of a disconnect. Like, even though they tried to bridge the gap with this movie, there still kind of feels like a disconnect between the First Class series and the original trilogy because they clear up some of the problems, but then there's this question of, well, if they had Mystique's DNA for all this time, why did they wait until 50 years later to finally do anything with it?
So,
because it was an immediate thing in the comics, you know, Senator Kelly dies, then they enact the Mutant Registration Act, and the Sentinels come in and everything, and it was like one domino after another.
Yeah.
This, if we're supposed to believe the timeline, it's Mystique kills Trask, she gets captured by the government, she breaks out, joins up with Magneto and the Brotherhood, they lay low for about 30 years or something before they finally decide to do something, and that's the first X-Men movie. Then you have that first trilogy. And then sometime after the Wolverine, because in the post-credit sequence of the Wolverine, we see the Sentinels appear on TV.
Yeah.
That's when the government finally decides to do something. So they wait like 50 years later to do something about this.
Yeah, the time issue is just a problem all the way through.
Yeah.
All these movies, they just, I mean, they set things where they want to set them. I mean, I was saying earlier, I do like the idea that First Class and Days of Future Past are really period pieces of from the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. That's kind of neat, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense with anybody other than Wolverine, basically.
It's
just strange. So,
And Fox seems like they're really intent on milking this whole period piece thing, because X-Men Apocalypse is going to be set in the 80s. So,
oh, is it? Okay, so we got the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. Okay.
It just makes you wonder, like, how many times are they going to keep beating this dead horse? Because are they going to do, like, the next one going to be X-Men in the 90s, and then is there going to be X-Men in the 2000s with Magneto being suspected of 9/11? And
gosh. Well, I guess it makes sense to keep doing them that way, so you can keep using McAvoy and all that.
Yeah, I guess so.
Instead of having to put him in makeup or something. I don't know. Yeah. Or recast, you know, conceivably.
Right. I mean, I think what they should just do is just, you know, reboot the series and just start off fresh.
Yeah.
And also another thing, I like, as much as I love both Fassbender and McKellen, you know, does Fox realize that the X-Men have more than one villain?
Apparently not. Right, I know. Because, I mean,
it was great when they used him in X2 because they found a different way to use him. But then after that, it's always just been Magneto as the bad guy, and it's starting to get a little bit old.
Yeah, I mean, it's... If they ever did... I honestly think if they ever did a series of Fantastic Four movies and did them right, it would almost be the same way with Doctor Doom.
Probably, yeah.
You'd have him at least lurking somewhere in the background or on the side involved, no matter who the main villain was or what the main issue was. They would just keep going back to Doctor Doom.
We saw that with the Rise of the Silver Surfer, because Doom ended up becoming the villain in that one again.
Yeah, there you go. And it's funny. I mean, that's one good thing about the Avengers not really having one supreme, you know, Lex Luthor, Doctor Doom villain. They have several, is that we don't have to worry about, you know, we haven't seen the same. Well, honestly, Loki has the danger of becoming that just because the actor, but I don't think he's going to do anymore. So, you know, we may not have to worry about that being a problem now. I don't think he's going to do anymore. So
I mean, he'll probably be in the third Thor movie because of the way that Thor 2 ended. But I don't think he'll be in the next Avengers.
Yeah, yeah, and then that's fine, because as entertaining as he is, we don't need Avengers with their wacky pal Loki. You know,
that's just
not what we want. All right, so let's kind of wrap things up by looking at the entire 7 movie series kind of as a quick overview. We I think we agreed that it has its highs and lows. It's been kind of a roller coaster ride. Where do you think this series kind of stands in relation to other series movies or other superhero and comics related movies?
That's a good question.
When we look back at it, you know, from a little more perspective, where will we kind of rank it, and what was it as major accomplishments?
I think the major accomplishments were that it showed that not only that superhero movies still have viability, but that you can do a superhero team movie. Even though, you know, the team is basically three people as far as Fox is concerned, but it's still like the basic idea of it is still there, and you know they said, like, you know, you can have a superhero team. As far as ranking it with, like, I don't think we would have gotten an Avengers movie if we didn't have X-Men first.
That's a good point. Yeah, I think it showed that you can put multiple superheroes and even maybe villains in a movie, and there are ways to make it work.
Yeah, and they also showed that there are ways to avoid the pitfalls that the X-Men movies fell into with, you know, just having like one major character, because everybody assumed that Avengers was basically just going to be Iron Man and his, you know, and his five buddies.
His amazing friends.
Yeah. And then it ended up being, you know, pretty much all the characters, like, I mean, Hawkeye was a little bit shafted, but other than that, all the characters got a lot of exposure, a lot of development.
I just can't believe we live in a world where anybody would have thought an Avengers movie would be Iron Man and his amazing friends. I mean, that just, I'm supposed to be very, very happy about that. And I suppose I am, but still there's just a part of me that just can't quite wrap his brain around it. So any last thoughts about the X-Men movies?
You know, it's been a fun run. I'm looking forward to X-Men Apocalypse, but I think Fox should just consider just rebooting it instead of just keep trying to see how they can meld it more into like more, because they just keep adding stuff into this kind of Frankenstein, this monster it's become.
It's true. Yeah, I know. I really like this series. Again, it's kind of like with the comics. It's not my favorite thing, but I really, there's a lot about it I really appreciate and enjoy. And certainly, like I said, the last two in particular, I've really enjoyed. I think I've liked the last two better than the first five, overwhelmingly. So, yeah, I agree. It may be time. It's probably past time, honestly, to kind of start over and bring, you know, the new technology, the new graphics and everything, and kind of start the story up and maybe even use different characters from the beginning. I mean, maybe now they could actually start us off with the classic, you know, lineup, or with the 1975-ish lineup. And
right.
And
well, I think Days of Future Past was the perfect place to close the book on, because you end the movie with, you know, this bright, happy future where, which that was one thing I loved about that, with that they got Famke Janssen, James Marsden, and Kelsey Grammer to come back and reprise their roles.
Yeah, that was pretty
cool. And they managed to keep a lid on it the whole time too, because I did not know that was coming.
Man, all right. Well, I guess that's going to wrap up our look at the X film franchise. I have to admit, even though I would appreciate them going back and maybe starting it over, I feel like that the last three, again, and to me, have been the best. And so I'm not complaining yet, but I totally agree that I think the time is coming. So,
yeah.
Well, Percival, thank you so much for coming on board. Tell the folks where they can find your stuff.
Sure. My central hub for pretty much everything I do is PercivalConstantine.com. From there, you can find links to my books, the podcasts I host. I do one on pulp writers, and I do another one, basically what we've been doing here, talking about comic book movies. Mm-hmm. And I also write a whole lot of comic book articles for whatculture.com, and you can find a link to those on my website as well.
Awesome. And I guess I'll just throw out for folks listening, check out Alpha Omega, Book 1, Hostile Takeover, which is just out from me on Prose's single shot line. And, of course, my most recent novel, The Shattering Legion 3, Kings of Oblivion, which is sort of my space opera, far, far, far future apocalyptic. Actually, that book literally is apocalyptic. Not to spoil anything, but I've written a lot of post-apocalyptic stuff, and I've written some sort of pre-apocalyptic stuff, but Legion 3, Kings of Oblivion is apocalyptic. So if you start that series out, you know where that's going. So Kings of Oblivion. So thanks so much for being on today, Percival, and we will have you back on again when the next occasion arises. I'll be looking forward to it. Thanks a bunch.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much.
All right, and the rocket's going to get on out of here. We appreciate it, everybody. Our time is up. We thank you for yours, and see you all down the road.
Griffin, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek. Classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.
Be patient with me.
Patience isn't my strongest suit.